Welcome to the Anthro to UX podcast, where you will learn how to break into UX with an anthropology degree. Through conversations with leading anthropologists working in user experience, you will learn firsthand how others made the transition, what they learned along the way, and what they would do differently. We will be discussing what it means to do UX research from a practical perspective and what you need to do to prepare a resume and portfolio. I'm your host, Matt Arts, a business anthropologist specializing in design anthropology and working at the intersection of product management, user experience, and business strategy. Let's get started. Everyone, welcome back to the Anthro to UX podcast. I'm Matt Arts. I'm here today with Rama Venelakante, a senior UX researcher and strategist at Intel, and previously a senior user researcher and UX lead at HP. So Rama, thanks for joining me. Would you mind telling everybody how you got interested in anthropology?
Hello, everybody. Thanks, Matt, for having me on this podcast. And I'm actually happy to be here and excited to talk about my journey into UX. Because it's been a lot of serendipity, and I think a sort of an inner yearning to get to the back end of things. I got into anthropology actually by chance, because I grew up in a community which was totally science focused. Nothing but science and technology mattered, because my father used to work in the nuclear power corporation, and we lived in a community which was full of engineers and scientists, and nobody else existed. So I was one of those odd ones who didn't want to do science. So I did my undergraduate degree in geography, and then I realized that I wanted to work with people. And it was still not the internet era, so I was not even familiar with the fact that anthropology as a discipline existed in India. And I actually applied to join a course for a master's in public administration. And the university which I joined, Andhra University, was one of the two universities in India offering anthropology at that point in time. The one of the only two universities in India offering anthropology at that time. Now almost every major university offers it. And when I applied for my public administration master's, they parked me in anthropology, saying you have to wait for a while till the seats gets rationalized, and then you will move over to the discipline of your choice. And the 1 week I spent in anthropology, listening to what I was listening, I was so fascinated by it that I didn't want to move out. And I somehow felt that's where I belonged and that's where I should be. So I refused to move out of that. And I've stayed with anthropology. So I did my master's in social anthropology. And once I finished that, of course, I was cautioned that I would be unemployable in India. And I was very aware of that. So as a backup, I was coerced into doing a diploma in public relations, hopefully that I would get a job somewhere and I would be off my dad's paycheck, which was very crucial for me. Very idealistically, I wanted to be off my dad's paycheck. And I mastered in anthropology. Then at that point in time, my father got transferred to Bombay, which is now Mumbai, a city with more opportunities. So that's where I landed up. And while I was doing projects to finish my PR diploma, somebody asked me, do you want to go and do work in market research? And I was like, what is that? I'd never heard of that either. And they told me, oh, you'll be studying people to figure out what they buy and do. I said, oh, it's studying people, so I'll try it. And at the most, I'll figure out I don't want to do it, and I'll at least I've tried it then. So I think my whole journey has been like that. Try out, and you like it, you pursue it. And if you don't like it, then you at least you've tried it out. So that's how anthropology happened. And I just did my master's. And since then, I've been a practitioner. I started doing my career as a qualitative market researcher in a startup. Somebody had set up a small market research firm. I was the employee number 3 or 4 in it. And I learned what is market research. I learned what is qualitative research, doing work in that field. And then I moved out of there to work in one of India's largest newspapers, doing editorial research and categorizing editorial material and for storage. And that point in time, it used to be stored on microfiche. So I come from a much earlier era. So I learned the need to actually archive information, so that it can be referenced? And how do you build stories based on, you know, even archived information? The background of things is very important. Then I went back to doing qualitative market research. There's a lot of qualitative market research in the FMCG category, a lot of work on foods. The fact that I was an anthropologist didn't matter. The fact that I was a social scientist who could do, you know, who could talk to people mattered a lot more. And I did, that gave me a lot of opportunity to interact with people of all kinds of hues in India. I traveled all across India doing field work and becoming comfortable with the fact that these are people I don't know, but I need to talk to them, and actually practicing doing field work so that you're getting information from them that can be used in business context. So I did that for, I think, another 3 years or something like that. And while I enjoyed the interacting with people and listening to stories, what bothered me was that I didn't know what or what the impact of the work I did was, because I was working with a qualitative research agency, one of, again, India's largest and oldest market research firms at that point in time. But I didn't know what it was going to be used for, because you were working on a project brief that was given by a client. And that bothered me that, you know, I was doing this task, it went back to the client as findings, and then they could do what they wanted to do with it. And I had no control over that. I think that quest sort of got me into trying to get, and I didn't really understand, I didn't have this concept of what is marketing and, you know, why would somebody need to do all of this. So I needed to know the context in which the work I'm doing made an impact. And because while I'm working with a qual research agency, that was all I could get, I actually went and enrolled in a evening course for a master's in marketing management with one of India's premier business schools at that point in time, Jamnalal Bajaj. So every evening after work, I would go in for class. Every weekend I was studying. And it's a different story that I didn't actually go get my degree in it, because by the time I finished, I got to my final years, I realized I'd rather be an anthropologist and not an MBA. And so I continued. I got the context of where my work fits in. And that was a key point, turning point for me when, at that point in time, India was actually launching mobile telephony in, services in India. And I got an opportunity to work with one of the first mobile service providers in India. And for me, that was super fascinating, because I also happen, I think, to be one of the earliest anthropologists to come into industry, work as a qual researcher, make a transition from, again, one of the earliest qual researcher to make a transition into the client side. And I think I was the first market researcher who joined a telecom service provider in the startup phase to do market research for telecom services, a facility and a service that India was not used to. Because at that point in time in India, for landlines, you had a wait list of something like a decade. You waited 10 long years to get a telephone, a basic telephone. So it was so fascinating to see that what mobile telephony was, and the sudden ability to be to have communication in your hands, and the way it impacted lives and lifestyles. For me, that was so fascinating to see how communication could change lives and lifestyles. And I loved the work I was doing. I got to do such strategic work in that area. I was doing it for the first time. There were no precedents, because mobile telephony is very different. That is, I think, one of the first services that is with you 24/7. No other service, not banking, not hotels, no, nothing else actually comes close to that. And at that point in time, internet was not so prevalent, right? It was not so widely available. But mobile, because internet was only through your laptops, and you needed to know how to use computing. But mobile telephony provides that window, and it was so fascinating to see how it changed things for people. And that, for me, actually opened my eyes to the fact that technologies can actually be empowering and enabling. And I got very curious to be in that field. I said, oh my, this is like so fascinating to see how people can do things because they have technology in their hands, which is so easy to use and so simple to use. They didn't need to know computing. They didn't need to know how to use a keyboard and a mouse, or for internet, the English language barriers that exist, because India is not very English literate in that sense. A large population in India doesn't know how to use keyboards and mouse in computing. For a large number of people, mobile telephony is the first computing device they're holding, and they can do so much more. And the fact that they can use pattern recognition and images to get things done. So that got me into this tech world. And when I was finishing with BPL Mobile, that was when HP Labs is opening up a labs in India. Hewlett Packard Labs is opening up in India. And I got an opportunity to be there. I was, I think I joined in year two when they had set up the rest of it. All the computer scientists were in, and then a few of us non-computing people were in. We had, I think, about two or three business researchers, and I was the only non-tech researcher, non-computer science researcher. And after some time, the business researchers are also out. So I worked with a bunch of computer scientists, and I did a lot of exploratory work to identify spaces for technology interventions, because the mandate at the labs was to invent things inspired from populations like India has, the kind of underserved markets and communities and spaces, but make those technologies relevant for the world. And I got to do a huge amounts of work in doing a lot of exploratory work, a lot of generative research. And for me, that was another turning point, because when you're doing market research, it's looked at as a support function. But when you're working in a research lab with other research scientists, you are actually recognized as a researcher. You are no longer anonymous. You actually get your name on papers and patents and things like that. And suddenly you become visible. So you know you have a voice and you have a face and you have an identity, and the work you do actually adds value, and it pushes the boundary for tech research. So that was very, very fascinating. I think I did it, that was such a wonderful period, I think, in my career. I got to do such wonderful work, working with such wonderful people, and also learning that the state of art is not the boundary. You can because you're in a research lab, you can push those boundaries. That's your mandate, that the limiting factor is not the state of art, but what you can actually make happen. And so that opened up so much to me. And I did things I think I didn't know I was capable of doing. And I got labeled, that was the first time I got hired because I was an anthropologist, which itself was very fascinating for me, because that was the first time I didn't have to explain why I'm an anthropologist and what do I do. Of course, I did get to answer a lot of questions. What do you do here? Why is she here? What value does she bring? And then to be able to demonstrate that value and be able to show results, that was I think that was really great for me. I think I was one of the first user researchers in India, doing user research in India. And on the job, I got to learn so much more. I learned how to do UX. I learned how to contribute to HCI research. So as I grew in the organization, because the kind of technology areas we were looking at changed, I learned how to grow my skill set. I don't have formal training in any of these areas, but I learned to learn and add to my skill set and adapt the way I deliver to fit and suit a lot of these areas. And then to see that the work that you do can actually set the direction for technology research as a UX researcher, because when you're looking at doing UX research or leading UX research for areas that you want to start enabling, then you're almost looking counterfactually, right? You're not letting the current status determine what you can deliver, but you're saying this is what I want to deliver, and this is how I'm going to make it happen. So a lot of the user research that I did set the direction for tech research, and that was very, very satisfying for me and very, very enabling for me. So I've transitioned from being just a user researcher to a UX researcher to contributing to HCI research, and do a lot of that work with designers, technologists, and to be able to deliver to all of that. And I think what is most important in all of that is being able to understand the users that you're working, you're trying to study, and also the users that you're trying to deliver to, and being able to make those connections. I think that was like super fascinating for me. And post that, I freelance for a bit. And last 2.5 years, I've been with Intel, working as a senior UX researcher. Intel was has been a challenge for me because I joined Intel during the pandemic, and I'm used to being out in the field, talking to users, you know, interacting with a lot of people. And suddenly I was working remote, fully remote, on hardware, something I've never worked on before, on target users, which is a developer community whom I've never worked with before, and completely remote. So the learning curve was very steep, very, very steep learning curve for me. But I think over the last 2 years, I've learned how to work in that kind of a scenario and still be able to contribute and understand the language of hardware technology and understand the language of user experience or developer experience in that space and be able to contribute to that. So that's where I am for now. Yeah.
Well, thanks for sharing your inspiring story. And there's obviously a lot in there to unpack. To start, I'd like to maybe just go back. Could you help set the stage for the listeners of, you know, what does anthropology really look like, I guess, in India then and now? Is practicing discussed? You know, do you have any sense if the curriculum, how the curriculum differs from that in the U.S.?
That's an interesting question, because recently somebody asked me about that and I was trying to figure that out. When I started there, like I said, there were just two universities that offered anthropology. But now almost every major university offers anthropology. And anthropology is actually a preferred subject in India, because that is one of these options that a lot of aspirants who want to get into the civil services in India, which is the government services of administrators, take up because they find it easy to understand. But as a practice, anthropology, I think, is still very much in the academic field. I don't know how much of it has come into industry yet. And from whatever little I've figured out, there are not too many people who have studied anthropology in India and practice in industry as much. There are, the numbers are growing definitely, but not like it is in the US. And also, I think in India still, more traditional branches of anthropology are offered. I may be wrong because I have not gone and actually figured out what all is offered. But from whatever little conversations I've had, there are not too many newer fields or newer disciplines of anthropology that are still offered in India. But we have a larger population of students who have studied elsewhere and are back in India trying to figure out where they fit in and trying out options for work and, getting into the industry. So that community is growing, yes. But as a discipline, I don't think there are too many who still offer the varied disciplines that are offered in the US and other places, yes.
And so, you know, considering that, you obviously had quite the challenge. You know, I think you said at HP, people were asking kind of, why are you there and how do you fit in as an anthropologist? And so while we have that problem here in the States as well, you know, it sounds like it potentially could be greater there, given that the appreciation for anthropology seems to maybe even be even less. So how have you learned to communicate your value, and how do you go about actually doing that?
Yeah, that's something I think over the years for me, how I communicate my value I think a lot of times I've done it and then figured out how do I talk about it. And talking about what I do is something of a more of a recent revelation for me, that I actually need to talk about what I do, because I think as anthropologists, we are trained to observe. I mean, not as vocal about what we do. And also, I think because a lot of it comes from practice, not from just from studying or getting a formal degree. A lot of what we learn and do in anthropology comes from practicing it over and over again over years. And And after some time, we do a lot of things very matter-of-factly, so we don't realize that we need to actually verbalize what we practice and how we practice it. For me, the way I make my value understood and felt is I always look at there are minimally two user groups that I'm addressing in all the work I do. One is the user group that I'm studying for whichever product category or domain I'm working in. And the second is a user group of stakeholders that I'm doing this work for. And I need to be very conscious that the stakeholders don't want to learn how to do anthropology or ethnography or any of that. You want to be able to tell them how to use the insights you have in the work they do. I look at what I do as an enabler, that the insights I gather from doing research or any kind of testing or anything else where I'm looking at the target users, those are insights that should enable my stakeholders to do more efficiently or better what they are doing. So the translation needs to happen at both ends. One is I'm translating the business questions for the users so that I can get responses and their insights on them. And then I'm translating those insights back to the stakeholders in a manner that they can understand so that they're able to put it to use without having to spend too much effort on it, because they are focused on doing what they need to do. And as an anthropologist and as a user researcher, UX researcher, I'm an enabler getting them to do that. And one of the learnings that I have is the language that you use to communicate the insights be the language of your stakeholders. So depending on the setting that you're working in, use whatever paradigms they are familiar with, the business paradigms. If you're working with the business leaders, then use the marketing paradigms, whatever models and paradigms they are familiar with. Use systems thinking, use solution life cycle, or if you're working with designers, use a double diamond, use a theory of change, whatever the paradigm that suits them and suits the context that you're communicating in. Make sure that the insights you're communicating are communicated in that paradigm so that they're not spending more time trying to figure out what your insights translate into actions for them. And I think that's as crucial as trying to find out what your users want from the products or services that they're using. And I think that learning for me has been sort of concretized because I started off working with a qualitative research agency, which means I was working to a research brief. I was working to a client's research brief, and I had to deliver actionable insights. So there could be no vagueness about the insights I delivered. They had to be actionable. So when I think I came in from the outside end, where I was doing client briefs to the other end of, being able to contribute to technology and services, that having actionable insights throughout is very important. Using the language of your stakeholders is very important. And you being the enabler between the users of your technology or services and your stakeholders, if you take that role very seriously, then that becomes very necessary for you to do, to be the translator. And for me, one of the other benchmarks that I use is a lot of times I tell myself that I'm creating knowledge repositories. I don't own any of that. And the minute I have got somebody else to understand the knowledge I'm trying to transfer to them, it becomes their knowledge. So they probably won't even acknowledge that it came from me. But if I see that change, that they're using the same language, or the next time you're having a conversation, it's one step up, then I've done my job. So the benchmarks I use internally for myself is this fact that I have transferred knowledge, and I've made sure that they're able to actually incorporate the insights into action in whatever work they're doing. So that becomes, understanding the business paradigms, and that's very, very important. And more so, I think, because a lot of times your individual contributors, you sometimes don't have a team of other UX researchers or other anthropologists that you're working with. At least that's been for me the case until I think I came to Intel, where there are at least other anthropologists and UX researchers. But I've mostly worked as an individual contributor and the only non-marketing or non-tech person in whichever organization I may have been. So for me, being that translator both ways has been very, very critical.
Now, you said understanding the business paradigms, but in your example with mobile phones, you know, there really was no frame of reference to understand the context of use in that scenario. So I'm working on a book right now on emerging technologies, and it's on, you know, anthropologists working in that space. And all of these people are essentially working in spaces that are sort of poorly defined up until this point. And so curious to hear, like, what did you do in that space where, in some sense, you know, you needed to really figure out how you're going to apply the theories and methods to, you know, an area that nobody's worked in previously?
One was, this is going back many years, so let me sort of look at that. One was actually figuring out, and when we launched services, I think there were very critical things that we needed to figure out, that where was the network going to be laid out, because because you had limited resources, you couldn't have laid the whole network out. It needed to roll out. So you needed to figure out how the network was going to be rolled out. And then you needed to figure out who would be the early adapters, and you would need to figure out, and at a later point in time, then you're looking at lifetime value of your subscribers and all of those things. So I did read up a lot on mobile telephony services that were rolled out in other countries, at least to get some reference points as to what I should look for. And then you need to understand the context a little bit. For example, if you look at India as a market, you know, and when there is something big game happening, like, you know, mobile telephony was a big thing at that point in time. So the pressures that will work on where the networks will roll out depend on not only where you will find early adopters, but where will the decision makers come from? If you look at the political scenario, you need to understand all of those things, that you have, you know, representatives of the people or in the government who come from particular areas in a particular state that you're going to roll out into. So they will use their political influence to say, okay, will you make sure that my area is covered, you know? So you do that. And then you figure out where are people going to be able to pay for things. So one of the ways to figure out where you will have paying customers is to find out where economic activity happens. And India, construction is a great indicator. When there's a lot of construction activity going on, you know that that area or that town or that city or that place has more money or economic activity happening, because construction is one very visible indicator of where, you know, there is fund flow. So you pick up all these cues to start figuring out which cities, which towns will come into your first set of rollout, where will it go out from there. And then you say, if somebody is going to have to pay for mobile telephony, then it has to be people who are making money. So you figure out what are the profile of a particular town. And then you figure out, where do these people live? Where do the people go to work to? What is the commute routes? Then is the traffic, how is the traffic flow? And based on that, you say, okay, this is where I'm going to enable. And, you know, then you say, okay, who are the people? Then you look at which is the central business districts. What are the profile of those business districts? And where do those people come from? What kind of trade do they practice? Is there a cash inflow seasonal, or, you know, is it steady? So all of these little indicators, which are nothing to do with mobile telephony per se, but you need to have that sense of everything else that is happening, because and then be able to say that this is how, these are probably the markets that will roll out. And then how do you find out value of communication? Because a lot of people haven't even had basic telephony. So how do you get people to understand what is this value of communication? So we did a lot of exploratory studies, and then we did the study on the value of a missed call, the fact that I didn't get a particular business or a deal because somebody trying to reach me couldn't reach me at a particular point in time. and somebody else got it. So trying to establish that value of a missed call, because it means money, or, you know, that I lost out on a business deal. So all of those became indicators. So it was fascinating to be using so many, you know, cues and indicators to try and determine these things. So that's how we meant. So that contextual understanding and that contextual understanding of the marketplace, the cities that you were going into, the people that you're working with, that became the political scenario in India. So all of that is an influencer. So you need to be conscious of all of that, which is why you need to be embedded in this to be able to do that. Yeah.
Well, and so speaking of embedded, you did also mention that Intel is the first time you've worked fully remote, and you're also working with hardware, which has arguably it could be helpful to be embedded and see that hardware in practice, right? And so tell us a little bit about how you've navigated that challenge.
Oh, wow. When I first got into Intel and I was working on these things, which I hadn't seen, I didn't know what. I was working on silicon. Intel's latest silicon gets offered. You have ODMs who build developer kits, so that developers have the first trial of what that silicon is capable of doing. And I didn't know. I mean, I know silicon is something, but I hadn't seen what it works like. Never worked with hardware, so it was a bit of a challenge. I was intimidated by it, but then once I get over that, then I get back into this thinking of how do I, as an anthropologist, one thing you know for sure is that you don't know. And you don't need to know everything, because you go in for discovery with populations that you want to study or communities you want to study, with the fact that I don't know and I'm going to find out, right? Because you're trying to get information. So if you use that same paradigm when you're working with your stakeholders and your thing. So I went in saying, okay, I don't know this, but I can use the same manner I use with my user communities. I can ask all the questions, get all the answers, make sense of it, and then build from there. And that's exactly what I did. I actually had so many questions to ask the people I was working with. I'm sure they will, if you ask one of them, they can tell you how many questions I have to ask. And I did ask a lot of questions. Then I got all my stakeholders into a room to talk about things, because they have been working on in this field for a long time. So a lot of what is called tribal knowledge exists in their heads. And not everything is verbalized, because most people assume that the rest of them know. But for me to get people into the same room and talk about what is being done and how it's being done and why it's being done the way it's being done. So that gave me an understanding of what the stakeholders' expectations were. And then we were working with ODMs who were manufacturing these dev kits. So using the product manager's knowledge and their links with the ODMs to try and get them to, you know, share with us what they're doing. And then actually abstract out what UX means in that whole space, and fix one thing at a time. In a new situation like this, I wouldn't want to go and change everything at once. I would actually want to work in the way it's being done, fix things so that people have a noticeable difference that they can see, and then take it to the next level, so that you're always getting one step up at a time. And that's how exactly I navigated Intel. I worked on, for the last year and a half that I've been working on dev kits, one thing at a time, fixing things, how content should be, how experience should be, one thing at a time. I think come to a point where you say, for all of these basic things that need to be done, I can make myself redundant, because everybody in that team that works, the ODMs, the stakeholders, the product managers, everybody, there's a certain level of expectation that is built, met, and then you're willing to push it to the next level and say, okay, we've got this all sorted out. So now let's push it up. So that's how I dealt with that. And it for me, it's still very surreal, because I'm used to being on field. I'm used to actually talking to my users. I'm used to observing the spaces they work in. And here I was working with things that were completely remote. But I think I've done okay. Yeah.
Well, so is there, appreciate you sharing all that. I enjoyed hearing a little bit more about, you know, how you're practicing in general, but also in India, and hearing some of the differences. Is there anything you have coming up that you'd like to share?
Few things, yeah. One is, I think, as anthropologists who practice in industry, the domains that we practice in vary every time. We are doing different things. And one needs to be very, very confident about your skill set. You should have practiced well. You need to own it. Be unafraid of things that you don't know. Ask all the right questions, and make and be very conscious of the fact that you have always working with at minimally two sets of users, that users of the product and service, and one is the users of your insights. So that, if you're very conscious of that, I think you do a better job. And start wherever, especially if you're coming into tech industry. It's good to have prior experience of having practiced your skill in some other domain, some other area, doing anything that has you customer facing or user facing, and then coming into tech industry, because most times you got to hit the ground running, and you probably get very little mentoring inside the tech industry. I don't know whether a lot of tech companies take interns at the UX level. So you need to be ready to hit the ground running. So that's very, very crucial. And make sure that the insights you get are actionable. And yeah, so that's I think, very, very critical for any anthropologist, especially if you're sort of new to the field coming into the industry. On a personal level, I think I would like to share that I've enjoyed my career, though I've learned everything on the job. I've not been formally trained in a lot of methods and things that now are available as resources to a lot of people, a lot of the newer ones who are coming in. But I've picked up skill sets which I think I've practiced and honed and added to over the years. So that's sort of been, for me, the exciting part of it. And on a more personal note, actually, my stint with Intel comes to an end end of April. I will be out of Intel by then. And then I will start looking for what am I going to do next. And I'm hoping it will be as exciting as every other opportunity I've had to do till now.
I'm sure you'll reinvent yourself. And so if anybody wants to reach out to you about that, how should they get in touch?
Well, I'm on LinkedIn, so they'll definitely find me there. It is Rama Venelakanti on LinkedIn, so they should reach out to me out there. And I think I'm one thing I've sort of consciously I'm going to try and do now, especially when I probably be in between things, is be more open and approachable to mentoring and coaching, which otherwise I do very informally when somebody gets to reaches out to me. But I think I finally realized that, or I've come to this thing that I actually need to speak up and, you know, actively coach and mentor people who are coming into user research and UX research, because it's not an easy field to get into, because you're competing with designers who do research, and you're competing with everybody else. So yes, I'll be happy to do that, and I would definitely like people to reach out to me for that too.
Well, Rama, thanks for your time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for having me.
Thank you all for listening to the Anthro to UX podcast. To learn everything you need to break into UX, visit anthrotoux.com. There you will find all the podcast episodes and career coaching resources. Please like, share, and subscribe. See you next time.